You're listening to event audio from the Brookings Events Podcast, part of the Brookings Podcast Network. For more in-depth analysis and commentary from Brookings scholars and our guests, go to brookings.edu/podcasts or listen via Apple Podcasts or your favorite podcast app. Don't forget to follow us on Twitter at Policy Podcasts.
Good morning, everyone, and welcome to Brookings. My name is Stephanie Aronson, and I'm the Vice President and Director of the Economic Studies Program here at Brookings, although, to be honest, I've only been in the role for 3 weeks. In fact, you all are the first audience I've had the pleasure of welcoming to Brookings in this new capacity, and so I'm very grateful to each of you for showing up here this morning. We're here today to discuss the current state of financial regulation and to hear from the person perhaps best situated to share the latest developments, Federal Reserve Vice Chairman for Supervision, Randy Quarles. Before joining Brookings, I too was at the Federal Reserve providing analysis to policymakers on the U.S. economy and labor markets in particular. So I recognize how critical a stable financial system is to our economy and to all who participate in it. In that role, I had the pleasure of interacting with Vice Chairman Quarles on a few occasions, and I'm grateful that he was able to stop by this morning and share his valuable perspective. Quarles was confirmed as Vice Chairman for Supervision a little more than a year ago. And just 6 months later, Congress passed new legislation to adjust several aspects of the post-financial crisis financial regulatory framework created by Dodd-Frank. Vice Chairman Quarles continues to play a vital role in the implementation of those regulatory changes, which is one of the many reasons I look forward to his remarks today. Vice Chairman Quarles brings to the Federal Reserve Board decades of experience as a banking lawyer in both the public and private sectors. Directly prior to his appointment to the board, he was the founding and managing director of the Cynosure Group, and before that, a partner at the Carlyle Group in Washington. He also spent several years at the Treasury Department, first as Assistant Secretary for the Treasury for International Affairs, and later as Undersecretary of the Treasury for Domestic Finance. Given the interconnectedness of the global financial system, his experience in both domestic and international affairs is surely invaluable to his work at the Federal Reserve today. I'll close with a little bit of information on today's program. We'll begin, of course, with prepared remarks from Vice Chairman Quarles. Following his remarks, he'll be joined on stage for a moderated Q&A with Brookings Senior Fellow Martin Bailey. Vice Chairman Quarles will also take questions from the audience. To conclude, we'll hear from a panel of experts moderated by Brookings Fellow Aaron Klein. With that, I'd like to welcome Vice Chairman Quarles to the stage. Thank you for being with us here today.
Thanks, Stephanie, and thanks to Brookings for inviting me to speak today. It's an honor and a pleasure to speak to this distinguished audience. Very pleased that people would want to show up for such a wonky topic. And obviously, Brookings scholars in this area are extremely distinguished. They include former chairs, vice chairs, senior leaders of the Federal Reserve, many others, some of whom are in this audience, who did the hard foundational work of developing and implementing many of the new post-crisis measures, including stress testing, which is what I want to talk to you about today, some of the changes we're proposing to make in stress testing. And under those circumstances, my showing up at Brookings and discussing changes to our stress testing regime could sound uncomfortably close to the serene arrogance of Alfonso X of Castile, who famously said that had I been present at the creation, I would have given some useful hints for the better ordering of the universe. My thoughts today, however, are not a call to rewrite Genesis. but rather a recognition that our stress testing regime, like the banking and financial system that it evaluates, will and should evolve as we continue to learn from experience in the management of this tool. And in the best traditions of the Federal Reserve, this evolution should be grounded in rigorous analysis of the data and a commitment to continual improvement of our methods. So in my remarks today, I'll begin with what's been successful about the stress tests, why those elements should remain. I'll spend some time discussing some of the changes we proposed to our stress testing program and how we're now thinking about moving forward with those changes. And after that, I'll discuss the tension between, on the one hand, providing additional information to the affected firms, while on the other hand, ensuring that the tests remain effective. And finally, I will close with some thoughts on the qualitative element of our stress testing program. The adjustments that I'll discuss are intended to increase both the transparency and the efficiency of the stress testing regime. Enhanced transparency goes to the very core of democratic accountability and to the rights of all U.S. citizens, including the management and shareholders of the institutions that are subject to the stress tests, to understand the requirements to which they are subject. And it also helps to ensure the continued credibility of our regime. So let me begin with a short discussion of the core elements of our stress testing program. So as most of you know, one of the most visible aspects of our stress testing program is that the firms and the public receive an independent view of the capital adequacy of the largest banks. The results are based on our own models and provide a consistent yardstick to measure resiliency across the banking system. But the stress test that's conducted by the Fed is only one part of our stress testing regime. Just as important, in our view, we require each firm to run its own stress test using its own models and a stressful scenario that reflects the firm's assessment of its idiosyncratic risks and key vulnerabilities. Underpinning a firm's stress test is the firm's ability to identify and measure risks under both normal and stressful conditions, and the strength of the firm's internal processes around that assessment, and we use our supervisory process to ensure that the firm's stress testing practices employ sound methodologies. So the combination of the Fed's common yardstick, the firm's own stress tests, and supervisory oversight over the firm's practices has resulted in a meaningful increase in the post-stress resiliency of large financial institutions. All of these core elements will remain in place. In addition, the changes I'll talk about today are not intended to materially alter the overall level of capital in the system or the stringency of the regime. A healthy U.S. economy relies on a strong, well-capitalized banking system that can weather stressful events and continue lending to households and businesses. The U.S. banking organizations subject to the 2018 Comprehensive Capital Analysis and Review, or CCAR, which is the Fed's evaluation of capital adequacy for large holding companies, have increased the dollar amount of their common Tier 1 capital from around $500 billion in 2009 to more than $1.2 trillion as of the second quarter of this year, have more than doubled CET1 risk-based capital ratios from approximately 5% to over 12% over the same period. But while the regime has been successful overall, in my view, I believe it's prudent to review all of our practices to ensure that they are as efficient and transparent as possible, and that they remain appropriate in light of changes in the industry that have been achieved. For instance, as firms become more resilient, they may no longer need to build capital to support their current level of risk-taking, but rather move into the mode of retaining the capital they've already built. Firms have also significantly improved their risk management from before the crisis, providing room to adjust our approach to assessing their practices. And finally, as we make changes to our regime, the issue of volatility in the stress test results becomes more pronounced. As I'll discuss, we're considering how to balance the need to preserve the dynamism in stress testing with the need to ensure that firms have sufficient notice regarding the capital requirements to which they're held. Now, Many of you in this room are familiar with the Federal Reserve's proposal to integrate the stress test with the regulatory capital rule, known as the Stress Capital Buffer, or SCB. And if you're not, you may be on the wrong plane. But I believe the SCB proposal represents an important milestone as we enter the next chapter of our stress testing regime. But for those who aren't quite as familiar with the SCB, let me provide a little background about how our capital rule currently works and how it would be modified by the SCB. So as devoted readers of our capital rules may know, our regulatory capital rule includes both minimum capital requirements and a buffer that sits on top of those minimum requirements. The buffer serves as an early warning to a firm and to its supervisors, and it requires the firm to reduce its capital distributions as the firm approaches the minimum requirements, as it eats through the buffer down to the minimum. Under the current capital rules, all firms are subject to a fixed buffer requirement of 2.5% of risk-weighted assets. And the largest firms are also subject to a global systemically important bank surcharge and a potential countercyclical capital buffer. For the large firms, the SCB would replace the fixed 2.5% risk-based buffer with a firm-specific buffer, the size of which would vary from firm to firm based on the firm's stress test results. In this way, we're integrating the automatic restrictions on capital distributions in the current capital rule with the output of the most dynamic tool we have for assessing risk, the stress test, to create a more robust and dynamic, but also simpler regulatory capital regime. The SCB would result in a more transparent and simplified system of regulatory capital requirements because a firm will be held to a single integrated capital regime. Now, when we made our SCB proposal last April, we'd aimed to make the SCB final for the 2019 stress test cycle. But the comments we've received have been extensive, they've been thoughtful, and they've raised issues that require a carefully considered response. I don't believe those issues will ultimately prevent us from implementing the SCB, but they've flagged certain elements of the regime that could benefit from further refinement. Accordingly, I expect that we'll adopt a final rule in the near future that will settle the basic framework of the SCB, but repropose certain elements. And to enable this process to run its course, I expect that the first SCB would not go into effect before at the earliest 2020. For 2019, I expect CCAR will remain in place for firms with over $250 billion in assets or that are otherwise complex. But we'll consider whether we could move forward with any aspects of the SCB proposal for CCAR 2019, such as assumptions related to balance sheet growth. And again, for people who are familiar with the proposal, you know what some of the assumptions about the content of the stress test, in addition to the form of the stress test that were included in that proposal. And we need to consider whether there are any of those questions of content that could be included in the current stress test, even though the SCB won't be effective for that cycle. I will also ask the board to exempt firms with less than $250 billion in assets from the CCAR quantitative assessment and supervisory stress testing in 2019 in light of the every other year cycle contemplated in the tailoring proposal that the board approved 2 weeks ago. Returning to the SCB proposal, I want to give you a sense of some of the comments we've received and our approach to addressing those concerns. The issue that's foremost in my mind is the volatility of the stress test results. One concern that was frequently expressed is that the results of the supervisory stress test can lead to capital requirements that change significantly from year to year, which limits a firm's ability to manage its capital effectively. Some amount of volatility is necessary to preserve the dynamism of the stress test. By nature, the stress test will differ year over year based on macroeconomic conditions, contemporary understanding of salient risks in the economy. And in addition, the stress test results are sensitive to changes in a firm's balance sheet, which means that a firm's capital requirements will evolve as the firm's activities and exposure evolve. But I do think there's an important balance to be struck between preserving this dynamism and ensuring that firms have sufficient notice regarding the capital requirements to which they're held. In the first years after the financial crisis, as the banking system was dramatically ramping up the total amount of capital in the system, this volatility was less of a management problem until we reached reasonably full capitalization. Every year, every bank needed to increase its capital. And if 1 year that increment was a little higher or a little lower than the previous year, That was simply a modest difference of velocity, not direction. At the current juncture, however, both our system as a whole and each of the largest banks in that system are fully meeting their capital requirements. Chairman Powell and I have both said on more than one occasion the amount of capital in the system is just about right. In these circumstances, having a highly variable capital requirement presents a significant management challenge. So we're considering ways of preserving the dynamism of stress testing while reducing its volatility. And we plan to seek comment on a proposal in this area in the not-too-distant future. And that's not too distant in real time, not Fed time. In addition, we're also exploring ways of improving our approach to measuring risks in the trading book. Firms' trading books are dynamic and complex. Firms hold both long and short positions. Many have noted that a single market shock doesn't adequately capture the risks in firms' trading book. Those are sensible comments. We're exploring ways to incorporate multiple market shocks in the stress test without adding volatility to the results and without increasing the compliance burden, which, as you can imagine, the Venn diagrams there overlap over a relatively small area, but that's what we're trying to accomplish. We're also considering adjusting another element of the SCB proposal in order to provide more notice to firms. Currently, and both how we currently run the stress test and in the SCB proposal, as we originally put it forward, a firm must decide whether to increase or decrease its planned dividends and share repurchases for the upcoming year without a knowledge of a key constraint, which is the results of the stress test. In other words, we require a firm to give us a formal plan for dividends and stock repurchases without knowing what its effective capital requirement is. If it guesses wrong, it could be publicly shamed for failing the stress test, if its dividends are too high relative to capital, or it could be penalized in the markets for inadequate distribution of income if its dividends are too low relative to capital. Now, admittedly, at first blush, this structure could appear to be pointless and obdurate cruelty, but the reason behind the practice was initially perfectly sensible. It reflected the view that firms should think rigorously about their capital uses and needs in developing their capital distribution plans, rather than rely primarily on the results of the supervisory stress test to guide those plans. But now that we've all had several years' experience with this system, firms have told us that they would be able to engage in more thoughtful capital planning if they had knowledge of that year's stress test results before making final their distribution plans for the upcoming year. I'm very sympathetic to those concerns. And I'll ask the board to adjust the operation of the rule so that firms know their SCB before they decide on their planned distributions for the coming year. This adjustment in sequencing will also help firms manage volatility in the SCB. Obviously, we expect firms to continue to maintain robust stress testing practices and to use those results to inform their capital distribution plans. We'll continue to use our supervisory process to reinforce that expectation. The comments that we've received also highlighted an issue with how the capital buffers operate today. And that's amplified by the inherent volatility of the SCB. So as I noted earlier, a firm operating in its capital buffer is required to reduce its capital distribution so that it can build capital over time. Now, by design, the buffer was intended to apply increasingly stringent limitations as a firm's capital ratios decline. So this, you're supposed to be moving along a continuum. But in our current world, in which a healthy and profitable banking system is seeking to maintain its capital levels rather than continue to increase them, a bank can appropriately and safely tend to distribute much or all of its income in a given year. It's in maintenance mode as opposed to increase mode. But in that case, given the way that the capital buffer rules are described, the minute you dip into the buffer, you would have to completely cease all of your distributions as opposed to having a gradual ramping down, even if the changes in your capital levels are quite minor. So we're considering adjustments that would make the rules more consistent with the graduated intent of the structure. And we'll work with the other banking agencies to consider how best to affect that change. There are two additional elements of the SCB proposal that I think would benefit from modification. First, the SCB proposal would have included four quarters of dividends in a firm's SCB in recognition of the fact that firms experience market pressure to hold dividends constant even under stress. But in my view, and this view is shared by many regulators around the world who have similarly stringent expectations and regulatory structures, there may be ways of encouraging greater reliance on less sticky repurchases while providing more flexibility in the regime, and we're exploring alternatives. And finally, the SCB proposal would have included a post-stress leverage requirement. Now, the Federal Reserve has long maintained, okay, so I don't want to overstress that. We've long maintained, we haven't always maintained. we haven't always maintained. I don't want this to sound too much like we have always been at war with East Asia. But we have long maintained that leverage requirements are intended to, are important elements of our capital regime, but they're intended to serve as a backstop to the risk-based capital requirements. By definition, they're not intended to be risk-sensitive. So I'm concerned that explicitly assigning a leverage buffer requirement to a firm on the base of risk-sensitive post-stress estimates runs afoul of the intellectual underpinnings of the leverage ratio. So I would advocate removing this element of the stress capital buffer regime. That's not removing the leverage ratio. Leverage ratios, including the enhanced supplemental leverage requirements, would remain a critical part of our regulatory capital regime and will maintain a supervisory expectation that firms have sufficient capital to meet all their minimum regulatory requirements, including the leverage backstop. Together, the adjustments we're contemplating to the SCB offer promise in improving the efficiency, coherence, and transparency of the regulatory capital regime while maintaining the overall level of capital in the system and the core principles of the regime that have proved successful. That being said, we welcome a continued dialogue with the public as we implement these changes, and through that implementation, we'll ensure that we maintain the incentives for effective stress testing practices that exist today. Now, transparency of the stress test and its inputs and outputs is key to the credibility of the test. And there are several initiatives underway to provide additional transparency regarding the supervisory stress test models and the scenario design process. We think that the adjustments that are under development strike the right balance of advancing transparency while maintaining incentives for firms to think critically about their own risks. So I expect that soon you'll see the Federal Reserve, and again, soon in real time, not Fed time, you'll see the Federal Reserve issue a policy statement describing governing principles around the supervisory stress testing process. As part of that statement, I'd expect a commitment to disclose additional detail on the supervisory stress test models and results, and to publish portfolios of hypothetical loans and associated loss rates. I expect that we'll begin providing some of this additional detail starting in early 2019, and that these changes will allow firms to benchmark the results of their own models against those of the supervisory models. But our commitment to transparency doesn't end there. We're currently considering options to provide additional transparency regarding scenarios and the design of the scenarios, and I expect that the board will seek comment on the advisability of and possible approaches to gathering the public's input on scenarios and on the salient risks that are facing the banking system in each year. Such a proposal may also provide additional details about the scenario design features that underpin each year's scenarios and a range of other enhancements. Additional transparency regarding the stress test scenarios serves multiple purposes. It provides additional due process to affected participants. And I, as a former lawyer, I couldn't underscore enough how important that is in any governmental process. But it also provides additional sources of insight, including from academics and thought leaders like many of you in this room, that could be used to inform a given year's scenario. Increased transparency could also enable us to be more nimble in our scenario design to the extent that we uncover through external input new salient risks that we haven't previously considered. As we develop proposals, a key consideration is to ensure that we maintain incentives for firms to conduct their own stress tests rigorously and thoughtfully. Firms have indicated that additional disclosure about models would not affect their own stress tests, and we expect them to make good on that representation, as the Federal Reserve stress test is not and cannot be a full picture of a firm's resiliency in light of its idiosyncratic risks. For example, there's some risk that firms will use knowledge from additional transparency about the stress test to engage in transactions that are solely designed to reduce losses in the test, but that don't truly reduce risk in their portfolios. As supervisors, however, this is something we can guard against through the regular examination process, and we'll closely monitor changes in the firm's portfolios and take appropriate actions to ensure that firms are holding sufficient capital and have sufficient controls and governance in light of the risk characteristics of their activities. Before I close, I'd like to say a few words about the role of the qualitative objection in our new chapter of stress testing. As originally conceived, and again, if this isn't familiar to anyone in the audience, by now you are scrambling to figure out how we can land at the nearest intermediate point and you can get on the right plane. But as originally conceived, CCAR had both a quantitative component based on the supervisory stress test and a qualitative component based on the Federal Reserve's assessment of a firm's stress testing practices. In 2017, the Federal Reserve eliminated the qualitative objection as part of CCAR for large but non-complex firms, in part because of improvements in risk management at these firms. That's not an elimination of our concern over their practices with regard to their internal stress testing and capital management, but by incorporating supervisory stress testing into the regulatory capital regime and introducing an automatic penalty if a firm falls below its SCB-derived capital requirement, the SCB proposal will eliminate the quantitative objection from CCAR. The natural next question is, has the CCAR qualitative objection for the largest firms also run its course? In my view, the time has come to normalize the CCAR qualitative assessment by removing the public objection tool and continuing to evaluate firm stress testing practices through normal supervision. In such an environment, firms would remain subject to the same supervisory expectations. Examiners would continue to conduct rigorous horizontal and firm-specific assessments of a firm's capital positions and capital planning, tailored to the risk profile of the firm. While much of the examination work would center on a firm's capital plan submissions, examination work would continue on a year-round basis for the large firms, taking into account the firm's management of other financial risks. The evaluation of the firm's capital position and capital planning would culminate in a rating of the firm's capital position and planning, and firms with deficient practices would receive supervisory findings through the examination process and would be at risk of a ratings downgrade or enforcement action if those deficiencies were sufficiently material. We would simply remove the public shaming element of the qualitative objection. So in conclusion, as we begin the next chapter in stress testing, my objective is to ensure the continued credibility of the program by increasing its transparency, its simplicity, and its stability, while maintaining the strength of the supervisory and internal stress testing elements that are central to the program today. These adjustments will be coupled with our continued commitment to strong supervision and our expectation that financial institutions ensure that they're managing their risks and holding sufficient capital to continue operations through times of stress. So thank you again very much for having me here today on this wonky topic, and I'm looking forward to our discussion.
Okay, the button works. Microphone works. So thank you so much. That was terrific. I got to hold the mic there. Thank you. My phone will probably go off in a minute too, but never mind. So thank you so much. As you're well aware, you've gotten some comments and criticisms coming from folks who think that the changes that you're making in financial regulation have not gone far enough, and so we're not doing what the president wanted to do, which was to increase the amount of lending, encourage economic growth. And then you've gotten criticisms from folks who think you've gone too far, that you shouldn't be loosening regulations, that Dodd-Frank should be kept in place and nothing changed. So I'm going to ask questions that sort of come at you from both directions, if that's okay. So. gentle questions. And so the capital rules that banks are facing, so this is sort of in the direction, have you done enough to try to improve or make regulation more efficient and encourage economic growth? So the capital and liquidity rules that banks face are or have been extremely complex. And the description you gave of changes to the stress test indicate maybe some simplification, but it still sounded like a very complicated regime. So, and I know that John Dugan, when we were working at the Bipartisan Policy Center, he used to complain there are 9 different capital ratios that he had to look at with the leverage ratio. Then there was the liquidity you have to look at as well. So do you you think you're on a path, or have you done enough to kind of simplify the capital regime so banks can operate more efficiently?
So I think we have proposed a lot. Our own count actually is that in the current regime, banks are subject to 24 separate capital measures, and with
so more than 9.
More than 24. Exactly more than 9, and with the SCB proposal that we put forward, that would reduce the number to 12, which is still more than 9. But it's a move in the right direction. And I think a significant simplification of the regime. And most of the comments that we've received have acknowledged that. Now, I think that at any moment we shouldn't consider, you know, the job of the Fed should never be to consider its work over, but rather to continue to think about, well, how can we continue to improve the efficiency of the regime? But I think that those are significant steps towards improved efficiency.
Let me ask you to comment on the Volcker Rule. So that's something that's been, it's in the law, so, you know, it's there. It's something that the banks have had a hard time with. It's something that regulators had a hard time sort of setting up. I think there is sentiment in the Federal Reserve to simplify the Volcker Rule. So could you give me a comment on that? I don't think we want to go back to the days when you had huge risky trading floors with inadequate capital, and we know where that went. But are there proposals, or how do you see the Volcker Rule playing out? And do you think it's actually damaging, for example, as has been claimed, issuance by smaller companies, smaller bond issues, because of the presence of the Volcker Rule making it more difficult for institutions to make markets?
So to take the last part first, I do think that there have been effects on markets from the Volcker Rule. They're difficult to quantify precisely, but there is, I think, universal sentiment among market participants that the Volcker Rule has affected liquidity in some markets, and I think that's probably true. Reasonable people can differ about the extent of that. I think that there is universal agreement that the rule as it currently exists is too complicated. It's too complicated from the point of view of supervisory enforcement. It's too complicated from the point of view of firm compliance. And I think that it is totally sensible, as for that matter does Paul Volcker, to have a much simpler approach to implementing both the letter and the spirit of the Volcker Rule provision in the Dodd-Frank Act. So I think that's eminently doable because, I said, there's universal agreement on that. The five relevant agencies are working together to process the comments, very thoughtful comments that we've received in response to the proposal that was put out earlier this year. And, so I expect that process will come to a successful conclusion.
When you announced the tailoring process, there were some comments, maybe some complaints, that you weren't doing anything for the G-SIBs. If the goal is to try to ease regulation, to make money more available for businesses, as Willie Sutton said, you go where the money is, and that's, to a large extent, that's the G-SIBs. So if the capital requirements are about the same, the TLAC requirements for those banks are about the same, maybe we're going to simplify the stress test a little bit, but have you done enough to make sure that large banks are able to play the role that's needed in order for a growing economy to have access to funds?
So we're continuing to look at the, you know, at the framework that affects the largest banks. As I've said, our objective is not to materially change their capital requirements. There are a lot of things that are in the works, Basel III implementation, for example, that would, other things being equal, result in material increases in their capital requirements. I think we have to think through how we think about that in light of an overall view that this is a system that, in which the capital level is just about right. But with respect to the criticism of the tailoring proposal that came out last week, didn't do anything, or maybe it's 2 weeks ago now, how time flies. didn't do anything for the largest banks. Well, that was focused on implementing CREPO, which didn't do anything for the largest banks. Not CREPO the man, but CREPO the bill.
The bill.
And, and required a huge amount of Fed resources. I mean, I don't want to necessarily overstress this, but I think we put out that implementation proposal in, if it is not the fastest implementation of a major piece of regulation in the history of the Federal Reserve, it is certainly among the fastest two or three, which required significant devotion of resources to that effort. And now that that proposal is out there and we're processing comments, we'll turn resources to thinking about other parts of the system.
Let me sort of cross the street now and sort of raise some of the concerns that have come from the folks that think maybe you're doing too much. So one of the most common things that I hear, and I'm sure that you hear, is to say, look, we have a very hot economy. People are reaching for yield. We're maybe even beyond full employment. This is a boom time. This is a time when we should be tightening the screws a little bit on the banks, on the financial institutions, not easing the rules. So we want it. It's really sort of the macroprudential approach. Could you comment on that reaction to the proposals?
So to that, I'd say a couple of things. One. To the view that we're relaxing in the face of a boom, I really don't view the regulatory proposals that we have put forward, those that we are thinking about, those that I talked about today, as relaxation. I think that what we're doing is recalibrating in light of experience the post-crisis regulatory regime in order to achieve the same objectives. There's no one on the Federal Reserve Board, no one in the financial regulatory leadership, frankly, that disagrees with the fundamental objectives of post-crisis regulation, which is to have more capital, more liquidity in the banking system, to have a safer and sounder system. But we also need to look at that framework through the lens of efficiency, because we have a strong public interest. It's not just a question of, you know, the banks feeling overburdened, but we have a strong public interest in the efficiency of the operation of that system and its support for the real economy wherever we are in the economic cycle. So that's the first thing I would say, is that I do think that when looked at fairly, what we are doing is sort of, I think, very justified recalibration as opposed to relaxation of the regime. But the second thing I would say is that we're, with respect to what people most frequently talk about is, you know, at this point in the cycle, shouldn't we be pushing against the cycle as the countercyclical capital buffer?
Right.
And we have a very clear framework that we have talked about for turning on the countercyclical capital buffer, which refers to an assessment of overall financial vulnerabilities. So the countercyclical capital buffer, as it was discussed internationally, as it has been implemented both internationally and in the U.S., is a financial stability tool, not a sort of macroeconomic dampener, if you will, and is designed to be, in our framework, quite explicitly, we say we designed to turn it on when we think that financial stability risks are meaningfully above normal. Now, quarterly at the Fed, I mean, constantly, the institution is assessing financial stability, but we have a formal quarterly process in which the board reviews with the staff our current assessment of financial stability risks. And our assessment currently, as we have said, is that those risks are moderate. There are certain areas where you have clearly elevated risk, valuation pressures in certain asset classes, certain sectors where there's elevated leverage. But overall, the very strong position of the financial sector, the low leverage in the financial sector, the high liquidity in the financial sector, the adjustment of household balance sheets, all of that feeds into an overall assessment that our financial stability risks are moderate currently, and therefore, in our disciplined and methodical framework, you would not turn on the countercyclical capital buffer. There are regimes around the world that are rethinking this notion and saying, well, maybe the countercyclical capital buffer could be used more appropriately as kind of a macroeconomic dampener as opposed to purely a financial stability flywheel, if you will. But we have not. We haven't done the work here. We haven't gone through that process here in order to do that. And so I think as we think about using that tool, we need to do that in a disciplined way. And our current discipline is to thoroughly evaluate financial stability risk, to view it as a financial stability tool. And in those circumstances, you wouldn't turn it on.
So in your judgment, and I understand that, the banks that you supervise and regulate are in good shape, so to speak, that they've got the capital, they've got the liquidity, and so you're not seeing red flashing signs going on, even though the economy is strong.
So we're not. I'm very mindful that that in my nomination hearing, similar statements that I had made earlier in my life were brought to my attention again.
they do that in confirmation process, don't they? Yes.
But no, we're not. We're going to be releasing later today a supervision report with a very comprehensive assessment of the current state of the banking industry, and all the data would show that it's a very healthy industry.
So, all right, so let's go outside the regulatory perimeter for a minute. I mean, one of the concerns about Dodd-Frank was that it would strengthen the institutions that are subject to Fed supervision or careful supervision, but there are institutions that are not as that you don't see into and that you don't necessarily regulate in the same way, that maybe have some other regulator. And I hear concerns about leveraged loans, for example, coming out of non-bank institutions. They're concerned about asset managers that may be reaching for yield and taking unnecessary risks. So, and I also note that the FSOC has basically decided that no non-bank should be included in Federal Reserve supervision. So are you comfortable with where the regulatory perimeter is, or do you fear something that would happen outside of that perimeter that would, in the end, impact financial stability in the banks?
So I think that's an interesting question. At the Federal Reserve, we regulate the banking sector, and absent designation have limited responsibility and visibility into other parts of the financial sector, obviously. But we do have some visibility, if you think about what the real risk is, it's whether some of these other structures that are holding these assets, how leveraged are they? And we do have visibility into that from the fact that the leverage will tend to come from the regulated banking sector. And that's something that we are always monitoring. Again, currently we don't view that as raising significant risks, but we are always monitoring that. I would refine a little bit your statement that the FSOC has said that no non-banking institution would be designated and placed under regulation by the Fed. I mean, the FSOC is focusing on a designation by activity, if you will, sort of right. Focusing on what activities are there, which I is a tricky thing to do, but is in fact being, quite diligently and quite rigorously pursued by the FSOC. And I think conceptually is probably even more accurate than the previous entity designation approach, because conceptually that's what we ought to be concerned about, is are there activities that could be conducted by any institution, whether it's a bank or a purple panda, that could be affecting financial stability? And if so, it's those activities that we ought to be looking at, and that's what the FSOC is trying to do.
Okay, I've always agreed with that, that it's sort of activities you'd like to regulate. It's actually hard to do because the activities occur within institutions.
Yes.
And so what's your control over that activity? It's through the institution, right? So I've got lots of questions I'd love to ask. I think I'm going to ask two more and then throw it open. So the resolution process, I've always been enthusiastic about the development of the single point of entry approach, the creation of TLAC, unsecured long-term debt, as a buffer in the event that a bank gets into trouble, and the process that I think the FDIC has put in place to resolve large institutions. But I think the question about that is, well, what if we had a really bad crisis, the kind of crisis we had before? Hopefully we won't for the next 100 years, but maybe we could. So we could imagine that a couple of G-SIBs were in trouble, going down, maybe a couple of other banks, two or three other banks. Could we manage to resolve all three, four, five institutions at the same time without there being a big crisis, or are we going to end up looking like the previous crisis? In other words, do you think this resolution process is really strong enough to withstand a big crisis that could hit sometime in the future?
So I think the best answer to that, at least that I have, the most honest answer that I have, is that I view the too big to fail project, if you will, as ensuring that policymakers have more options in the event of the next instance of very widespread stress. And I think that the post-crisis regulatory regime has done that. I think the work that's been done on resolution has done that. So if you do face a period of widespread stress, I think that policymakers will have more options. Which options they choose, what they choose to do, will depend on the circumstances of the time and the policymakers at the time. I also think that what we have done with respect to resolution significantly puts off, reduces the likelihood that you will have kind of the need to resolve many institutions. One of the reasons that many institutions were resolved, even in the last crisis, was the uncertainty as to how you could resolve even one.
Yep.
And I do think that our ability, the much greater clarity we have into how we could resolve even a very large institution, even if it were only singular, reduces the risk that you will then have to resolve three if it's clear how you can resolve one.
Okay. All right. For my last question, I want to go back, since your speech was about the stress test, I'd like to go back to that. And you mentioned the increase in transparency around the stress test. Now, I must admit, I was surprised when the stress tests were put out that there was so little transparency. And I know the banks sort of felt they were, walking into a minefield. They didn't know what was coming. When I talked to folks, I remember a conversation with regulators at the Fed in New York. Their view was that we don't want to give away the exam questions before the student takes the exam, because then the exam wouldn't be worth anything anymore. So you've decided that you want to increase transparency. So say a little bit more about how you've done that in such a way that it makes it easier for the banks, but at the same time, presumably, you're not just giving away the exam.
So for me, the question about giving away the exam, I will admit that I've always been a little skeptical of that, about the ability of the firms to game. For me, the that part of the criticism or support for opacity. It's really not a question of giving the banks the test questions as opposed to are we going to give them the textbook. But I do think that there is a genuine concern about the so-called monomodel problem, which is that to the extent that it is absolutely clear what the Federal Reserve's stress tests are going to show, what the models are, there's an almost irresistible incentive. I mean, it's just going to happen that because that will ultimately govern, that that's what the banks will do, and their own thinking about their internal risks will erode to some extent. Now, I don't think that they, you know, it's not like the Will of Landru from the old Star Trek, and they're only doing what the Fed says, but...
I missed that episode, sorry.
I can do them all, but...
that's right.
Good for you.
But... but nonetheless, there would be that erosion. And, you know, and as I said in my speech, the Fed does not have it exactly right. No one who's going to have that complex of a model is going to have it exactly right. There's going to be judgments. There's going to be mistakes. There's going to be idiosyncrasies. And if there is one model to rule them all of the risks in the system will congregate around those fault lines. So I think that's a real concern. Now, opacity is only a halfway measure in dealing with that concern, because one of the reasons why there's less noise about transparency than there was even a year ago when I arrived at the Fed is that the banks are reverse engineering. Every time you have an iteration of a stress test, it's easier to figure out, oh, so that's what happens. That's what they do. That's what they're thinking. And so ultimately that, you know, that monomodel problem doesn't disappear simply because we are opaque about the model. So I think we have to do more thinking about that. But that's why we are proposing more transparency, because I think that's a matter of due process. I think that I think we get more comment from folks in this room about, you know, how can you improve the test to ensure that it remains dynamic and useful. I'm less worried, as I said, about the gaming issue. And we need to continue to work on the monomodel issue.
Thank you. I'm going to ask for questions from the audience. Could you please identify yourself? Could you make it a short question and not a speech, and hopefully relevant to the topic of this event? So we have one at the back. Yes. Please identify yourself.
My name is Mark Tenney.
Oh, wait, we do need a mic.
Thank you, ma'am. Yes, my name is Mark Tenney. I'm involved with capital and asset adequacy work in the life insurance industry, and I helped calibrate the economic scenario generator used to set capital and reserves for life insurance companies. Currently, the Academy generator, which is required for reserves, is unable to create scenarios that start at zero, go to five, and back to zero in short-term rates, and has trouble keeping rates close to zero for long periods of time. Just to give you a little bit of information for those not familiar. Life insurance companies do 10,000 scenarios at monthly intervals.
We need a question in there here, yes.
Okay, so the question is, the inability of the Academy generator to produce what I call the Larry Summers scenario, short rates go from zero to five and back to zero, or to produce long periods of low rates, do you consider that a systemic risk? And do you think that they need to improve their generator to include those scenarios?
So I haven't considered that question up to now.
I was going to say, I'm glad you're answering that question. <not me. laughs>
but I would say that as we think about stress testing, and my own view about stress testing is that it should, you know, you should have the ability in the creation of scenarios to design a variety of different shocks, and some of them should be quite unexpected shocks. There's a question as to then what you do with the information that you get, but the point of stress testing is to shock the system in ways that might not otherwise be expected, that aren't day to day. In the 2018 stress test, we included an actual steepening of the yield curve, even in light of a significant macroeconomic event, which is not what one would normally expect to happen, but which could happen. There were reasons to think that this might be an environment in which it might be particularly, you know, that unusual thing might be somewhat more usual than others. So how would the system evolve in result of that? And I think that those sorts of unexpected shocks is something that a good stress testing regime ought to have the ability to incorporate and not to do.
Question. Here, yes. We need a mic on the side here.
Hi, Heather Long from the Washington Post. Are you concerned at all about the slowdown in the housing sector? I get notes that say it's a canary in the coal mine for the broader economy and maybe even for banks and bank lending. Curious what you think.
Okay, so I'm one thing that I should have probably have made clear at the outset, but the we just had our FOMC meeting yesterday, and our blackout policy extends for one day after the meeting to, I guess, to prevent us all from stampeding over each other out of the room. So I actually can't comment on sort of macroeconomic or questions that would affect monetary policy today. I'm sorry about that. Ordinarily, the meeting is over on Wednesday, and I think when we set the time,
was
precisely because the meeting would be over and then because of the election, although we should have known when the election was. But in any event.
we were just happy we found a date at all. That was a long struggle. Okay. Question here. And then I'll go to the back.
Morning. Raj Date from Fenway Summer, Vice Chair Quarles. Thank you for being here. I marvel at your ability to render these hyper-technical issues in ways that are very slightly less hyper-technical. So thank you. If you had asked me 10 years ago, which you did not, but 10 years ago, I would have thought that if we had both higher and more transparent levels of risk resilience in the system, that one, yes, depressingly would see lower returns on equity, but simultaneously one would see lower costs of equity because investors would sensibly, you know, expect less volatility. Is that A, true, and B, happening? And if not, what do you think about why not?
So I think that's an interesting question. I think that I think that it hasn't really been true up to now, but I think that's because there's increasing capitalization of the system. But there's an increasing awareness of investors or a different view of investors as to what capital is necessary in order to make an institution safe, and therefore a different point at which you reach the area where increasing capitalization will in fact result in a sort of decrease in the ability of the system to provide credit and economic growth. And so I think up to now, we're only just entering that area. We've been building capital in the system up to now in a general sense, I think a correct sense, that, you know, that there was always more to come, and appropriately so, and each increment would, in fact, make the system safer without a particular cost in its ability to provide credit. Now I think we're operating in the regime or in the region of that continuum where additional additions to capital, they may make the system safer, but they will come at a cost. That's the more normal regime where we thought we were operating before and we simply had misjudged what a safe level of capital was. And so now operating in that system, I think we'll see that effect operate in a more traditional way.
Yeah, we had a question at the back.
Thank you, Governor Quarles. Edward Mills, Raymond James. Had a question about CECL. There's a big push right now for there to be a cost-benefit analysis on the standard, something that you seem to have supported previously. A lot of concerns about making sure there is a harmonization between the accounting standard and regulatory capital rules to make sure that there is not a, you know, extra counting of capital and not a negative pro-cyclical impact of the rule. Could you give us an update as to how you view the need for a cost-benefit analysis and how the Fed and other regulators could harmonize the standard with existing capital rules?
So I think we've propose this. If you haven't proposed this, we'll propose it shortly in real time. But you know that from the regulatory point of view, we will phase in the use of CECL in our regulatory capital calculations. That will give, and we'll phase it in both with respect to the spot capital regime and with respect to the stress testing capital regime. And that will give us time to evaluate what the effect of CECL is going to be, because I agree with you. There's a lot more. We've gotten a lot of data. A lot of it is conflicting as to both what the day one effect of CECL is going to be and what is there's less controversy, I think, less disagreement about what the effect of CECL will be in times of stress, that it will be procyclical, and therefore how do you address that? That's particularly important for our stress tests. It's also particularly important if there were ever any actual stress. So, but our view is that by phasing this in, by allowing a long time before it's fully effective, we will be able to do this further study to understand exactly what the implications are and therefore how we ought to respond.
Well, we're running over time. I'll take one more question here, and we need a mic. It's coming.
Hi, Brent Sutton from the University of British Columbia. Where do we stand on the incentive compensation rules? The second set were issued in 2016. I think they're in limbo at the moment. And secondly, is it possible that you could use the joint guidelines that have already been issued as a way of meeting the requirements under 956 of the Dodd-Frank Act?
The incentive compensation rules have, we've received a number of comments about the proposals that are out. There are a lot of technical issues with them. However, we are very much mindful of the of the incentive compensation principles that underlie that provision of Dodd-Frank and that underlie the regulatory proposals in our regular supervisory engagement with the firms. So that is something that we take into account. We look at firms' compensation practices when we do our regular examinations. It's not something that I think I said to Senator Menendez, this has not been fallen behind the refrigerator and been forgotten about. Our press people don't like me to use that phrase, and I just used it again. But
stick with it. Go for it.
We are focused on that in our engagement with the firms. Turning it into a rule, has raised a number of technical complexities. We're continuing to work on that, but it is not. While that rule is still being thought about, it's not something that we're not doing in our supervision and regulation of firms.
Thank you. Please join me in thanking Vice Chair Coyle. That was just terrific. Thank you so much. Fantastic. We have a panel, please, a very distinguished panel with I think, a lot of fun. So please stick around.
Kathleen? Okay, come up. Anyway. Where do I go? So, as my fellow panelists get seated, and before we begin, and I will introduce each of them, I'd also like to state that Davis Polk and Sullivan Cromwell firms where two of our panelists are currently employed provide generous support to economic studies that makes the work we do possible. I'd like to reiterate Brookings' commitment to independence and underscore that the views expressed today are solely those of the speakers. That brings me to introducing this distinguished panel. I'll start immediately to my left and work down. Rajan Cohen is the best introduction I've heard of Rajan is he's the counsel to the situation. Rajan, one of the foremost banking experts in the country, senior partner at Sullivan and Cromwell. Kathleen Day is a professor at Johns Hopkins University. She's had a distinguished career as a journalist, as a consumer advocate, and is somebody who has covered multiple financial crises and written lengthy books, including a new one forthcoming.
January 8th.
That will
Yale University Press.
Help us better understand the commonalities between the various financial crises that many of us in this room have lived through. Chris Brummer is hot off the press at Georgetown University, where he conducted, I think, certainly Washington's preeminent FinTech Week, but perhaps the nation's preeminent FinTech Week. And I appreciate you joining us and being able to shift gears from the future of technology to the current regulatory structure. Randy Gwynn is the person who probably has spent the most time thinking about how to solve the failure element of too big to fail, both from a policy perspective and from an institution, real-world perspective. There is nobody I've ever met who understands living wills, the TLAC capital regime, and the intellectual structure behind that better than Randy, who runs the Davis-Polk practice in this and thinks deeply and holistically about these issues. So with that, knowing who the panel is, I want to try to do something that is rarely done, which is I want the panel to react to the speech and what Governor Quarles said. And in that way, I'd like you to just hold your comments. I think Governor Quarles committed to the Fed introducing one policy statement, seeking three notices, having multiple changes in regulation, all in real time, not Fed time. But let's start by just reacting to the substance within Governor Quarles' statements on stage, and we'll broaden it out in a little bit. But, Rajan, what was your takeaway?
My takeaway was that the commentators who have said this is a do-nothing Federal Reserve are about 180 degrees off the mark. You can hear what is coming. I think the vice chairman was very clear about what real time means. I mean, he started with a biblical reference, and I've always thought the Fed sort of worked in biblical time. You know, everybody lived to 500 years, and so you had all that time. But I think he's very committed, and I think what you've heard is that the basic building blocks of the post-2008 regime will remain intact, but it's time to take a look at all the extraneous accoutrements that have been built in and see whether they really are necessary and really work.
Okay, well, I'm going to take my longer.
No, I'm just focused.
Just on what he said today. To translate it in the vernacular is things are great, checks in the mail. This is what people said right before long-term capital, right before the meltdown. We have as much complexity. It's a new bunch of alphabet soup with, you know, FSOCs and all these things. But I think there's a lot of confidence that history might challenge.
Chris? I viewed really the remarks as a continuation of a process that was initiated. And I think it is, by all accounts, a much more ambitious process than many people first had anticipated. To move the regulatory pendulum in a direction that allows for more flexibility, for sure, but it's being operationalized in a highly technical manner. That does create certain real questions as to the long-term robustness of our response mechanisms should the economy start to slow.
So it's interesting. Three guiding principles that has guided what Vice Chairman Quarles has done in the Federal Reserve over the last year or so has really been by Quarles, which is transparency, simplicity, and efficiency. And I thought the speech today was interesting because it was very transparent. One of the things that I've learned over the process of seeing so many rules be proposed and implementing Dodd-Frank and things is that it tends to be a static process where you have a proposal, you submit a bunch of comment letters, you hear nothing, and then you see the final rule come out. What I've learned over that process is a better process would be much more of a give and take over a period of time. And what I thought was really refreshing in Vice Chairman Quarles' speech today was how he actually talked about a number of the comments and how they're thinking about them as opposed to it being a black box. And I think that that's really positive. I think having much more of a dynamic comment process so that we actually get to the right result is better than what I think I've seen a bit more in the past in other areas.
So let me pull on that string a little bit because I mean, I think the Fed can be commended in great detail for embracing huge increases in transparency in monetary policy over the last 25 years. And there was a theme, I agree with you, of an increase in transparency throughout his speech until you got to the very end, when on the qualitative remarks, the comment was, we're going to pull back the public element of it, creating less transparency, and handle things in a confidential manner. Did anybody see that as a tension between the broad themes?
Well, it's interesting. I guess what I would say, as opposed to commenting on, you know, was that a pullback by him? I'm not sure. That certainly is a characteristic of the supervisory process. I personally think the supervisory process should be more transparent. I'm not sure it can be as transparent as a matter of reality as monetary policy, but I think it could be a lot more transparent than it is now. I think if you went back in history, and one of my partners, Meg Tyre, has written a piece on this, the scope of information that was considered to be confidential supervisory information was much more limited than it is today. I think the perimeter of confidential supervisory information is much too broad, and I would like to see more transparency. I guess I think that Vice Chairman Quarles and the General Counsel, Mark van der Weide, are proponents of more transparency, but it takes time to have that be realized.
You know, Aaron, I think we're talking about really two different but related terms here. One is transparency, and the other, which I think Randy very much was focusing on as well, is meaningful dialogue. And dialogue, you listen to one another, you just don't talk at each other. And I think what you are hearing from the vice chairman is the opportunity for meaningful dialogue. And I will express my views that I do not think meaningful dialogue translates into regulatory capture. It really does mean listening.
One thing I hadn't thought of until this moment when the comment period was brought up. Lately, there has been some question about whether the comment process, how you're going to preserve the integrity of it. There's been, the Wall Street Journal did a review that some of the things for the FCC, some of the SEC comments, I think some of the regulatory comments to the Fed have been fake and astroturf. So no agency has really pursued that. So it's great to have a dialogue. I just hope it's not with bots. It's real people.
You know, I think that there are different kinds of transparency. I think I would also applaud the governor in to the extent to which you have any public official who's willing to engage the public about the thinking behind those decisions. There is always this tension, of course, when you want to introduce transparency into other aspects of administrative policymaking, such as, for example, the transparency with the metrics behind your stress testing. You know, one of the things that I've written about, and we call it the trilemma, usually with fintech, for the innovation and the difficulty of writing rules for financial innovation, but I think here it's also applicable, is that there's usually we already talk about trilemmas as, you know, with economists, but for regulators, there's often a trilemma between clear rules, market integrity, and financial innovation, that you can get two, but not all three, that you can get clear rules and market integrity, but it usually comes in the form of prohibitions that can impact financial innovation. You can have market integrity and financial innovation, but sometimes that'll come at the cost of complexity. And then you have financial innovation and clear rules, but then sometimes that'll come at the cost of market integrity. And here you see attempting approaches to accommodate that trilemma in administrative rulemaking, right? Both in terms of the dialogue process with the public and an attempt to change the way in which the stress tests themselves are operationalized from an ex-ante perspective. Right? Now, the question is, you know, again, historically speaking, you can only get two of the three, but maybe as to how you stand between those poles, depending on the toolbox and how you design the tools, which can engage and involve public engagement, or it can you can have changes in the regulatory rulemaking process and the way in which you design different stress testing scenarios and how much of the rule book or the textbook or the rule or the lecture that you want to provide in advance. And you can sort of move the dial, but sometimes there's a trade-off involved. And part of the conversation that will no doubt come from his remarks will be just how far in one direction are they pushing in terms of those trade-offs.
So let's broaden the conversation a bit beyond just what Governor Quarles said today to the whole suite of changes that have gone on since the passage of Dodd-Frank and the crisis moving towards regulation and now fine-tuning or pulling some of it back. The Fed had a giant sweeping proposal with four new tiers that came out, was the subject of some dissent, which is rare among the Federal Reserve voting governors. But let's react to the broader set of new changes going on at the Fed. Rajan, what's your take?
Well, I'll go back, Aaron, to what we were talking about a few minutes ago. This is not designed, this suite of changes, and there are a number of them, not only the tailoring, but the adoption of the proposal on the new LFI rating system. It could have very substantial ramifications. Again, its approach, it is around the edges of what is being done. You heard the vice chairman say, we're not going to change the basic capital standards. I see little prospect of a change in the basic liquidity standards. But it's not surprising that there are going to be flaws and errors in 10 years of regulation, or that the circumstances have changed sufficiently. And I think what we're seeing is a relatively comprehensive response to what has occurred in the last 10 years.
Kathleen?
Can I do the big? He knows I've been waiting to say this. So I think that these comments all have to be taken in a more general general comments on what's been going on at the OCC and the FDIC. And if you put all these things together, I'm old enough, I think probably older than anyone on here, I've heard all this before. And if I had a nickel for every time I heard transparency, simplicity, and efficiency, and the other two, and this is when I reach for my wallet, is when I hear financial innovation and consumer choice. When you hear those two words, reach for your wallet, it typically. So I just would like to take all the things that are some of the main things that have happened with all the regulators, because they do act in concert, and give them the broad category. So now we have preemption with the OCC's new fintech charter. If you read through all the lines, what it's really meant to do is clear out the hurdles of being able to go into different states. So now we have preemption, one of the ingredients for the last crisis. Now you have lowering of capital standards, weakening of the Volcker rule, although, and I'm not saying none of these things should be changed at all, but you're weakening them a little bit. There you go, cheap credit can easily become easy credit, overly leveraged, a problem. Then you have deteriorating standards. You have the OCC saying, oh, let's get the banks, we're not only going to say you can do it, but we encourage you to do payday lending. And you have the the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau, at the same time saying, and guess what? We're going to lower underwriting standards. No more assessing a person's ability to repay. If you can go into their bank account and take your money back, even if it puts them in financial ruin, so be it. So now you have this deteriorating standard, and with the lowering also of the capital rules, you have more self-regulation. We know how well that went before. And then there's amnesia. The amnesia auditing at OCC called the banks he's supposed to regulate his customers. Again, reach for your wallet when you hear things like that, because the customer is the U.S. taxpayer and the U.S. public. And finally, I won't go into the fiduciary rule, but that's another bee in my bonnet. I just want to say, in doing my most recent book, I really came to understand that founding fathers did not include the word bank or corporation in the Constitution because they were such divisive issues, and they are still divisive issues. But one thing I think we have forgotten is when you have a federal charter and you have federal deposit insurance, it is a privilege. And with that privilege comes an obligation of regulators who extend that privilege to these organizations on behalf of the public and the taxpayer to make sure they remember who their customer is, and they go in and regulate with that in mind. And I understand the need not to overregulate. I look, I will admit this now. I would never admit another form. I joined the Libertarian Party at one point. I don't want regulatory overreach. I'm not there anymore because I don't want to have to pay a toll every 1 mile on the road. But and I'm not quite that far. Those were my younger days. But I really do think this idea of having an incorporation and the privileges that the government bestows by giving it to you and deposit insurance comes with an increased obligation. And I think the regulators forget that. We're all embroiled in all this alphabet soup and FSOCs and SIFI. I mean, look at the big picture. So there, I've said it. I won't say any more.
So that was a lot. I'll start this way. I think that if you're just going to stay for the moment, with the Fed, I think what I think is a particularly salient point that's already been discussed is that these are not choices made in a vacuum, right? That they are instead following upon other kinds of choices. So you can have decisions relating to lowering certain kinds of capital charges. You also have the removal of some liquidity requirements for your financial assets for some smaller, medium-sized banks, which is a choice. You can always ask yourself, are the current standards too stringent? Should they be weakened and be made more appropriate, or should they be eliminated altogether? And there are certain kinds of choices that are made along that particular spectrum. And for some of the banks, it was, to remove altogether. Just as with, say, a countercyclical buffer, something that was discussed, we are certainly in times of plenty, and there are choices to be made. When you go about an analysis and you ask yourself, looking at the data, is the provision of credit, the rate at which credit is being provided, is it outstripping your GDP growth? Right? As a general matter, that's deemed to be a source of some financial instability or can pretend a future source of financial instability. And depending on what country you are and under what kinds of circumstances, can you implement it? I don't want to fiat, but these are all important choices that collectively can have an impact on the degree to which regulators not only will be able to respond to a crisis, but can prevent that crisis in the future. Now, the only one thing I would push back a bit on is that, and I do think that all of the financial regulators are looking to operationalize rules that they believe are either more efficient or to looking at rules that they think are too burdensome for the provision of financial services. Now, that being said, when you look at, say, the OCC charter, is that a question of preemption? Well, the state regulators who don't like the OCC fintech charter, no doubt about it, aren't necessarily preempted from trying to compete with it, but it does raise interesting questions that the OCC and other banking regulators and even other financial and capital markets regulators are trying to deal with. But that itself is trying to... The agenda behind some of these efforts involve questions that I think are worthy of real attention, like financial inclusion, capital access, and the like, particularly when you look at incumbent players in the market and their ability to service underbanked and the unbanked, as well as obviously some of your more traditional financial market participants. I talked much longer than I had intended to, but
can
there
I
was
make
a lot.
So just okay, go ahead. All right. Then I'd like to make two comments.
We'll get back.
So I'm going to stick to the original question, which is the tailoring proposal by the Federal Reserve that recently came out and by the three regulators on capital and liquidity. It's interesting because you see reactions on both sides of this one. So there's, at least at the extremes, they're very unhappy people. So on the one hand, there are tweets that say it's a tragic mistake. It's going to allow what Kathleen is talking about in terms of undercapitalized banks and underliquefied banks. On the other extreme, there are those, I'm not sure I've heard this since that it came out, but at least before there were letters from Congress saying you should exempt completely the banks between $100 and $250 billion in assets the way And that's what Congress intended by the Economic Growth Act. Instead, what the Fed has done is it's taken sort of a middle approach. And when you actually look at what has happened, I mean, they've sort of got four categories. For those of you who haven't read it, there's four categories. And the G-SIBs are in the top category. Very large banks that have cross-border operations are in the second category. Then banks between 100 and 200, then another category. The last one is between 100 and 250 billion in assets that don't have certain other factors. And if you actually look, and they've got a nice chart at the back, that basically you see that most of the capital liquidity of stress testing still applies to the largest banks. And to the extent some of them have been eliminated for the smaller banks, there's still internal stress testing on liquidity. There's still a lot of the capital requirements that are there. So in many ways, it's almost designed to make the people on the extremes unhappy either way it goes, because it is sort of an incremental, modest approach. But I think it's useful in thinking about where the Fed has come out in this proposal, and obviously people will comment on this. Where did the $50 billion, where did the magical $50 billion threshold come from to begin with? Was it based on some kind of empirical studies that this was a division between systemic and non-systemic? No, I think it was sort of pulled out of the air. In fact, I think it was actually designed to be fairly low, so that the idea was that the Fed would, in fact, tailor among institutions above $50 billion. It's just the Fed never really tailored a whole lot until now. So it's interesting to see
that. So having been there when the magic 50 number was created, from my memory, I believe the number was purposely set too low because of concerns about moral hazard. There was a giant concern that proved to be well overstated, that the market would see any institution over 50 as having a too-big-to-fail promoteur, and it would gain a comparative funding advantage. And if you set the number so low that it became obvious that the government would allow institutions over that number to be failed, the market would be fooled and unclear who would benefit from the imprimatur of moral hazard that I believe was turned out to be overblown. But I do want to push back a little bit and see the panel saying, so I viewed the Fed as creating three tiers, a tier of G-SIBs, a tier of large regionals that are over 250 and below 700, and then the 100 to 250.
That's right.
It created a fourth tier, which was one institution, which was Fed speak, because we don't want to actually name one institution, so we call Northern Trust Tier 2. So we're not singling out Northern Trust. They just happen to be the only entity in Tier 2. One of the concerns given in the dissent on this was that the law only addressed 1 to 250. And the Fed's tailoring, which is consistent with other aspects of Dodd-Frank, but was not part of S2155, dealt with the changes to the institutions over this new magic number of 250, which maybe is pulled from the same air as 50, just differently. How did you see, did that surprise you? And do you think the Fed's decision to grant them relief is in the long run best interests of the economy? Chris?
Well, I want to piggyback off that question to ask Randy's thoughts on that, combined with the frequency of the stress testing. If you move from a 1 to 2 year window, what does that do? Not so much from the standpoint of disciplining mechanism for the supervised, but from the surveillance perspective of the regulator itself in terms of its own internal information gathering and surveillance.
So let me just try to answer, at least I'd say, Aaron's implicit question, and then let me try to answer that one. I actually think the Fed in Dodd-Frank has always had the authority to do the tailoring
That's
that
right.
it's done. I don't think it required the Economic Growth Act to actually say it can do it. So the fact that the Economic Growth Act, raises the additional threshold from 50 to 100 and then has another threshold between 100 and 250 precludes the Fed from saying, well, we'll do further tailoring, which is what they've done with the, and I agree, it's basically three categories, and then there's a G-SIB light category, right? Or at least global light. And I think that's something the Fed probably should have done a long time ago, is to tailor more. I'm just not sure that they could do it. They were working so hard on getting the basics down that I think it's now the time to sort of look at tailoring. So even though the Economic Growth Act came out and set those thresholds, I think they're probably looking at it more holistically and say, here's our... And I think actually looking at risk factors as opposed to only size, you know, there's asset size, is actually a good idea. I'm not sure I agree that the five risk factors they come up with, including size, are necessarily the right ones or equally weighted the way they are in this proposal. But because but I think it's actually the right way of going about it. I think it's more sophisticated than just size thresholds.
No, I'm just going to say, you know, it's a question always of where you draw lines. And if you look at the banks in that category, are they closer to the G-SIBs or closer to the regionals in the next tier down? I think it's very clear. It's the latter, not the former. So some modest form of tailoring for that group seemed perfectly appropriate, and I agree 100% with Randy that the Fed has clear legal authority to take that action. Again, if we were talking about taking that group and really reducing capital requirements or reducing the liquidity requirements, that could be a whole different analysis, but that's not what we're talking about here.
Let me ask a different question about where you draw the line, which is the treatment of foreign banks. They seem to have been, the line seems to be drawing a very different line on foreign banks than it has historically in the United States. Chris, do you see a global implication there? Is this America first in banking?
Well, you know, whether or not you look at banking, whether or not you look at derivatives as well, there's always been a propensity. I mean, whether or not you look at the risk weighting for sovereign assets, you know, there's always been certain kinds of advantages that have been given to domestic financial institutions, even when it comes to the operationalization of your banking regulations in light of G20 and FSB and Basel Committee rules, standards, and best practices. Certainly, you would expect that this would have the impact of incentivizing local banking in a way that would have a disparately negative impact on foreign banks. But do I view this as so beyond or out of sync with certain past aspects of banking regulation? No. Now, is it contrary to some of the principles of cross-border coordination and standard setting that were embraced particularly in the wake of the financial crisis? I'd say yes. So, I don't know, I'm a lawyer. It depends. Yeah.
Thoughts on the treatment of foreign banks in the new regime?
You know, the Fed has said that they are going to come out quickly. I didn't hear quite the real time that Randy was talking about. But I think the foreign banking community, with some justification, believes that it is being, and I'll use the word, discriminated against by the entire American regulatory and law enforcement regime. It is not just the Fed. But this is a series of enforcement actions, which to the foreign banks seem more severe. It's, as a regulatory matter, you can almost look one more biblical reference. Original sin was the IHC. And, you know, the IHC was supposed to make foreign banks comparable to U.S. banks in terms of regulation. But now the U.S. regionals are being, their regulatory scheme is being changed to some extent, but IHCs, there's still nothing there. And it goes, for example, to how they're going to deal with directors. Just a number of issues are coming together, and it is creating real animosity among the foreign banking community.
I mean, from the FBO's perspective, I think what they see is they are being treated on a global basis now. So, for instance, they're compared to G-SIBs if they're a large institution. Historically, I think the way the Fed had divided its regulation, it usually focused on U.S. operations. And so from that perspective, they look at themselves and they say, our U.S. operations are a lot more like regional banks than they are like G-SIBs, and that's how we ought to be compared to. And so there's a tension between, do we compare them at a global level based on their global operations, or do we compare them for regulatory purposes on a local level? And at least their perspective is, these are regional bank operations that ought to be compared on a local level.
So it sounds like then Trumpism is winning a little bit. let me go from the rest of the world.
Well, I mean, you know, it is interesting, right? I mean, because we've had iterations of this conversation in this room, you know, but just under very, very different guises. So, you know, when it comes to capitalization and whether or not you're going to force international companies to place all their assets in any particular jurisdiction under Tarullo's plan, you know, people could have argued then that was a an America First program, right? Because you want to make sure that locally there's enough assets, you know, you can grab whatever you need in cases of financial stress, right? Okay, in this particular instance, you can make similar kinds of comments, and I think it depends on the historical context, and that's why I think my answer was it depends, because it's not unusual for the United States or any other country or jurisdiction to impose rules and regulations that have a disparate impact, and the international community can, in some cases rightly, identify that treatment as not being consistent with its international either commitments or principles that they embraced elsewhere.
You know, if I could, this is such, I'm sorry to keep yeah. continue, it's such a great question, and it's a burning issue. I think it's actually coincidental with the America First. It just has happened. As Chris pointed out, the IHC was developed by Governor Tarullo, not by this current board. But you can see from the foreign bank perspective why they see this as a reflection of a global approach.
So I want to pick up on a banking pun of disparate impact and transition a little bit to American consumers. In the financial crisis...
I want to see how you're going to do this.
The concept on disparate impact, on the regulatory treatments that affect certain groups of people more worse than others. And while leaving Dodd-Frank, the Federal Reserve's financial regulatory authorities were expanded significantly. The one area where the Federal Reserve saw a transfer of authorities was in consumer protection, which had frequently been neglected, not just at the Fed, but across federal banking regulators. Congress created a new agency tasked with doing that, the CFPB, put in charge a series of forceful single independent agency heads. One former head is sitting in the room right now. Under this administration, the president's chief budget officer has been placed in charge of that, and has gone about taking a much sharper course correction than I think any of the other bank regulators.
Course correction, or is it veering off the road?
Well, one could say it's a good question, Kathleen. Let me ask you then, follow up on that. You've seen these crises before. You use the term reach for your wallet, which I think is shorthand for consumers ought to be afraid. Holistically speaking, is there a connection in financial stability perspective between the new White House-led CFPB's perspective on consumer regulation and what's going on in terms of fine-tuning and calibrating other bank capital standards?
So this has succeeded in making this really wonky. It's not a wonky subject, especially when you have a crisis. He is going to have to, he meaning the speaker, Quarles, is going to have to preside over a system. And within that system are these FDIC-insured institutions. We struck a bargain. You have the taxpayers on the hook. And that with deregulation, Gramm-Leach-Bliley, which just formalized deregulation, you then put that safety net over everything. And I guess in real times of crisis, you know, we used to let investment banks go under. But it stopped when you really think about their affiliation with FDIC-insured institutions, which I'm fine with. I don't think it's a problem undoing Glass-Steagall. But there was a lack of oversight, of policing. And I would like, first of all, I would just like to say this. I would hope we would never have to have used the phrase non-bank bank again. But here we are with the ridiculous, Mr. Otting, who considers the banks his customers. But the ability to repay, what's going on at the CFPB is extremely pernicious. They are saying, we can give loans again. Go ahead, give loans again to consumers without assessing their ability to repay. That was always a code for you can abuse them at your leisure. And let's not forget, and this is something Bernanke really stressed after the last crisis, that you imperil consumers at your own risk. They account for 6 to 7 cents of every dime spent in the economy. And what we discovered is they didn't need more credit at the end of that crisis. They needed less debt. They had been abused. You need to have common sense. If you are lending people money without assessing their ability to repay it, I always tell my students, believe it or not, these are the very things that the toxic subprime did. Why are we there again? What are they thinking?
And then Paul's just like, Chris?
No, I'm looking that way and this way.
Okay. So I think that there are definitely ways in which you can expand access to credit as well as access to other vital financial services, whether or not it be insurance, even healthcare, and that the way that you do it is important. I do want to note that when you look at the housing crisis, right, loans were extended to people who couldn't pay, and there was...
On terms they couldn't repay.
On terms that they couldn't repay.
They didn't understand and were purposely, they were misled about.
Right, but I'm trying to say that the incentive behind it was that, you looked around and, houses
they,
were...
No, that was always a card. They were never trying to increase housing.
Kathleen, let Chris...
Okay.
I think that there was largely a desire that you look at minority communities and you want to make sure that they can participate in GDP growth and economic growth to the same extent that their counterparts, because houses are, at least historically, have been financial assets that allow for the creation of wealth. That's not a controversial statement that I'm saying, and I think that many people, particularly... not just, frankly, on the Hill, but others would look at one's house as their primary family asset. Now, the way in which you can encourage that can come about in different ways. And one of the things, if you're trying to responsibly think through financial inclusion and a wider participation in the financial economy, there are ways to do it. And I personally disagree with a lot of things that are happening over at CFPB, including their policing of discrimination policies and what's happening with their office over at the CFPB. That being said, I'm someone who, I teach law, and I like to look at institutions, and I like to look at things in their particularity. And, if you're going to create and generate wider financial inclusion, you may want to think about alternative data, the kind of incumbent data that's been generally used to facilitate the provision of credit, which has had a disparate impact on women, small businesses, as well as minorities. And you can think through how you want to, which was really one of the original ideas behind Project Catalyst and some of the other CFPB goals, as designed by other speakers who've come through here, including one of your senior fellows, Michael Barr. And to think through, how do you trigger and lever other kinds of tools in a responsible way? And I do believe that, as with many things in financial regulatory policy, when you have people who are, and I'm not talking about anyone in particular, but as a general phenomenon, when you have in the regulatory agencies folks who are on the front lines of political battles, that can lead to a polarization of the debate, where sometimes it's better to look at the end goal and to achieve the kinds of outcomes that I think that you're very, and that we're all very passionately interested in and in achieving. But I do think that that the CFPB's approach has been more aggressive, ostensibly, than some of the other financial regulators. And I personally would. Explore other kinds of options to achieve the kinds of ends for which the agency was originally devised and created.
So I'm going to turn to the audience for their questions now and give
Rajan and Randy the opportunity, if they want to weigh in, whether or not a series of new consumer abuses could potentially lead to a repeat of what we saw before with a sleepier CFPB.
Answer, I think, in part, first of all, could consumer abuses lead to a financial crisis? Here I agree 100% with Kathleen. The evidence is there. It could. There's no question about it. But whatever the CFPB's position may be, the bank regulatory agencies were not stripped of their authority to examine these institutions, and they are examining them as fully and as comprehensively in the consumer area as they were 2 or 3 years ago, 5 years ago. So I think there is, what Congress did was create a double level of protection.
All right. Who in the audience has a question? Right there.
Stress testing and the Basel is based on you'd get some accounting number out of the balance sheet and maybe you adjust it, and then you multiply it by a ratio like 8% for capital or 10.5%. And then for the stress tests, they increase some of these numbers based on judgment. But you're still taking a balance sheet item and multiplying it by some ratio that doesn't change for market conditions. So the 8% capital for banks, like insurance companies, if interest rates are really low, that's bad for their business. If the yield curve becomes highly inverted, that's usually bad. So, but that doesn't change these ratios. So the at least as far as the Basel numbers are concerned.
What's the question is?
Okay, whereas the life insurance industry does 10,000 scenario stochastic of monthly cash flows, and that actually sets the capital number. And so for me, my question really is, this has been going on for 30 years. Why is the banking methodology so primitive compared to life insurance?
I have no basis for knowing whether it is or isn't. So
maybe they have state regulators. I don't know.
I think with insurance and banking, you're dealing with apples and oranges in terms of the a bank. You give them your money, and a bank gives you their money, and you promise to repay them. With a life insurance company, you give them your money, and they promise to repay your heirs. Right? By definition, they're not going to repay you. And so, I think you have to look at that difference. We have a question over there, Alan.
Actually, I have an answer.
Well, hold on.
We're not
answering other audience questions. We're giving the audience a chance to question the panel.
Okay, I'll rephrase it as a question. data in the insurance world is far better than data in the banking world. Anyone who is an objective observer of the banking world understands that the central problem with data hobbles their ability to do analysis. And so the question is, given that there are now open source free data standards for financial instruments being created, why have the regulators not adopted this to enable the type of assessments that the insurance industry does?
Data standard question.
I'm going to plead the same fifth, it's the 11th, ignorance on this issue. I think, though, that life insurers and banks are not the same animals. They may be both animals, but they're not the same. To Aaron's point, who pays whom, but also life insurers have very long-dated liabilities and long-dated assets. That's not where banks are. So having different systems doesn't mean that there's something inherently fallacious in one or the other. I fully agree if there are opportunities to use better data, it should be used whatever you are, whatever type of animal you are, but the animals are just, I don't think, the same.
Dennis?
Hi, Dennis Kelleher, Better Markets. I hate to break with the theme here and ask a question related to what you're talking about, but 2 points. One is on the threshold, whether it's $50 billion or $100 billion, or you pick your number. Let's remember that. There's almost shy of 6,000 banks in the United States. If the threshold's at $50 billion, there's only about 40 banks in the United States with more than $50 billion in assets. This is not an insuperable or huge class of banks for the Fed or any other regulators to deal with. And even at $50 billion, and Better Markets actually put out, because this has been debated for so long, a fact sheet under 165, the Fed had full authority to tailor above $50 billion in every type of prudential standard that was to be applied, similarly for the stress test. So the issue was not that they couldn't do it. And in fact, our argument, and we showed that they did do it before. The question now is whether or not it's appropriate based on an individualized risk assessment of the banks. And the question for you that I have is whether or not you think they get there closer on an individualized risk assessment based on actual activity. Size was always the threshold question, not the substantive analysis. And the second point I wanted to just get your thoughts on is on FBOs. I mean, let's remember that foreign banks received trillions of dollars from the U.S. government. Frankly, you know, the Fed substituted U.S. taxpayers for German taxpayers to bail out Deutsche Bank's U.S. operations. And then Deutsche Bank and Barclays, as you both know, reorganized themselves to avoid the capital rules, which is what forced the Fed's hand on the FBO rule. So I agree completely, Raj, that there's a lot of discrimination, or a lot of, I should say, apparent discrimination, particularly on the law enforcement side. A little bit less clear. So the question is, doesn't the United States have a self-interest? If we're going to pay the bill, shouldn't we make sure that, in fact, the bill next time for the foreign entities are going to be ideally as low as the bill will be for U.S. entities?
All right. Two questions.
Answer? Yes.
That was the answer to question two.
That was the answer, yes, to question two.
Question one, on individualized risk assessment versus categorical assessment. Randy, hold on.
Yeah, I'm happy. So it's interesting because if you actually look at the tailoring proposal, that's my label for it, they do actually have an alternative possibility, which is they've got the categories the way they've defined them now, and then they've actually talked about having another approach that seems more close to what you're talking in terms of risk-based, sort of a multi-factor individualized assessment, kind of like the way the GSIB are done, GSIB surcharge. That strikes me as, interestingly, probably maybe one of these trade-offs you're talking about, because it might be more precise, but it may be more complicated and complex as well. And there is some value to simplicity. I think I wanted to get your original point, which is I think part of the problem, part of the real push for these new thresholds and raising the threshold from 50 to 100 is the fact that the Fed, over the past 8 years, didn't actually tailor things. And so you found a bank with $52 billion in assets that was subject to virtually the same CCAR stress testing requirements as the largest U.S. GSIB. And that didn't make a whole lot of sense, and that really irritated a heck out of a lot of the smaller banks. And so they then complained to their, you know, members of Congress and Senate and so forth. And so I think that was probably, in retrospect, a mistake. Probably should have tailored things more and I saw this also on the living wills. I mean, the idea that some of the smaller institutions were required to do living wills with the same kind of guidelines, part of the problem there was that the original guidelines, the regulators were kind of in the dark, feeling their way, trying to figure out what guidelines should we have. And so there's a lot of experimentation. That's one thing. It's one thing to have that kind of experimentation with the banks with very large resources. It's another thing to have that experimentation take place with the smaller banks where it was really a heavy burden relative to their size. So I think that I think tailoring is a good idea. It should have been done a long time ago.
So I had a quick response, though, I would say, to the FBO and the question of the German tax figure. And, you know, we're just in an environment where I'm increasingly mindful of the implications of you know, this urge here. But even when you look at the fact that, yes, either through our swap lines and through other varying assistance provided by the United States in the wake of the financial crisis, you know, I would only urge that we not forget why many of these countries were in troubles in the first place, because they were taking other wonderful exports from the United States, including U.S. Blue jeans and credit default swaps, which impaired the balance sheets of different institutions who were themselves, their balance sheets were intertwined with those of sovereign governance, and obviously because of the strategic place of the U.S. dollar in the international financial system, they needed a line of credit. But, you know, it wasn't a one-sided relationship, and the reason why many sovereign governments were finding themselves in financial stress was not entirely due to to what they did themselves. So we live in an interconnected world. We live in an international economy, and that's that.
But once again, the regulators weren't keeping track of the risk. Instead of using derivatives and collateralized debt to mitigate risk, they were allowing these banks, foreign and domestic, to use them in a way that amplified it. So again, they fell down on the job. The question should be, how do we get regulators to do their job? And that's to protect the public and the taxpayer.
Hi, Sabrina Terry with Unidos US, formerly the National Council of La Raza. I have a question that may be a bit tangential, but it's linking back to the discussion around access to credit or increasing access to credit and capital. The OCC has proposed monetization of the Community Reinvestment Act. I would love the panel's feedback on how those proposed modernizations may or may not lead to disparate impact for traditionally underserved communities, and if there are areas that are lacking within the proposed rulemaking that should be addressed or at least should be assessed in their, you know, process.
CRA is the legislation banks love to hate and hate to love, but they do like it privately. They think it's worked pretty well. That's what they will tell you privately, and for three decades I've heard them say that. We don't know what the proposals are. But again, I am anxious about what the proposals will be to change it, because again, we're hearing about consumer choice, innovation, access to credit, all the buzzwords that were being used for the housing crisis, when in fact, and we're opening doors to home ownership, when in fact 9 out of 10 of the mortgage-backed security of the mortgages underpinning the toxic mortgage-backed securities went to people who already had a home, including disproportionately in the Black and Hispanic communities. And because the house is the number one way that people move up the economic ladder in this country, by causing so many people who had a home, putting them into a bad mortgage, causing them to lose their home, that effect is going to be felt in the economy for decades. Those people. So I think the devil's in the details. We haven't seen the details of what they're going to do, but
so,
I'm worried.
So two things. And the point of the conversation, and I'll get to CRA in just a second, because it's particularly important as applied to something like the FinTech Charter, right? Where, for example, you know, if you're going to talk to members of CBC, it'll be of enormous importance for Maxine Waters and others. You know, to what degree are you going to, make sure that the CRA and both its principles or form or in some way or another are operationalized in a world in which you're engaged in online lending and where it's much more difficult to discern and identify the geographic boundaries of both the credit provider or the lending entity and the ultimate customer of those services, right? And that's going to be a question that I think, particularly given the election, there's going to be a lot of attention to that. And frankly, for people who are traditionally concerned about access to capital, in particular for minority communities, the question has always been, if people are really interested in access to capital and financial inclusion, and frankly, having a much more balanced growth of the American economy, then you have to make sure that everybody is involved in and is participating. And that's going to be a question that's going to arise. When it came to the earlier issues relating to the housing, there was goodwill, I think, behind a lot of people who wanted to make sure that everyone was able to participate in the American dream. But the rules that are developed by regulators to achieve that don't always get those results. And the question that will be posed here with the OCC, and I think we're largely intersecting, is, you know, how do you lay out those CRA rules, to the extent that I understand them, I think that they've been, that they're in the process of getting comments on the CRA proposal that's just been released, and many of us will be providing those comments.
Could I just very quickly, I think I ascribe fully to this point Chris is making, the debilitating impact of economic inequality is something we need to deal with. There are so many ramifications, but a modernization of CRA could be very helpful. CRA is now 40 years old or so, and it's still based on a branch model, right, bricks and mortar. That's not where so much of financial services is today, and we need the agencies to get in a room, sit down. This should be a very high priority because it could be so helpful in the area of economic inequality.
So it could also be very harmful.
Yes.
It's interesting that only the OCC has moved forward. There is a finite amount of regulatory bandwidth that the Fed and Vice Chairman Quarles laid out a pretty aggressive and real-time agenda. Did not mention CRA, nor did the Fed go along with it. But I've long held that the single best thing the Fed could do to help address income inequality is move to a real-time payment system. For the 60% of Americans who live paycheck to paycheck, who get huge check cashing overdraft fees, when your check clears is the matter between billions of dollars, in the aggregate, billions of dollars or needing a payday loan. For the 40% of us who always have money, never touch the zero lower bound in our bank account, we frankly don't care and we're oblivious to the large economic consequences of a payment system that I think is state of the art from the United Kingdom of 1853. The UK got real-time payments in 2007 when the first iPhone came out. I got an iPhone XR yesterday and a check that if I deposit it today in the bank, may be available on Wednesday or Thursday next week. Rajan, the Fed's come out with a proposal here, or a request for thoughts. They're holding town halls across the country 10 years after other central banks adopted the same technology. What do you think's going to go on here?
Well, I am concerned, and as you started to avoid any misperception of conflicts of interest, we represent the clearinghouse, which has an RTPS up and running.
Real-time payment system.
Up and running. And frankly, I don't think it is useful for the Fed to be going out. They had their faster payment systems task force, what, 3 or 4 years ago. What would really be useful is to support with their they are going to regulate it. They'll be able to fully in every way, including true ubiquity in the sense that the small banks, the Dennis referred to, the 6,000, which did not develop the system, have access on full and fair terms. That's where I think the Fed should be going, because I agree, it is a real issue that needs to be dealt with, and we've waited too long.
Only because...
Last word.
Well, only because I actually thought that I was, you know, going to be talking about crypto assets to some extent. You know, there's this very interesting question of central bank digital currencies, and we were over at the IMF just last week, and it's a question as to how can you operationalize some of the financial inclusion, faster payments, much lower cost, and more competition with the traditional banking sector through, if not innovations with, from everything scaling or from the scale of accounts with central banks to central bank digital currencies. And I agree, it's very important, and I'll let everyone go home.
Great. Thank you all very much. We appreciate that. Your time. Join me thanking the panelists.